Welcome to another Tactical Civics Liberty Cast, empowering Americans to enforce the Constitution and restore liberty.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Tactical Civics National Conference call for June 23rd of 2019. And these calls are held every Sunday evening at 8 o'clock Central Time in the evening, and is brought to you by the American Gen Trust. The American Gen Trust is a private charitable trust and member organization that's creating, defining, and leading Tactical Civics, a new way of life for productive, responsible Americans to restore a republic and American liberty. This is a way of life unique to these United States. The people themselves overseeing our public servants to ensure that they obey our highest law, the U.S. Constitution, or face the consequences. My name is Johnny B. Michael. I am a co-founder of America Again, and I operate the call board here in Kansas.
Thanks, Johnny B. Well, I'm David Zuniga of Texas, founder of America Again Trust and Tactical Civics. We always begin with prayer, so please, if you would agree with me, if you're a Christian, before our Creator. Our Father and our God, we come together again tonight, first in a spirit of thanksgiving. You put us here, not in Venezuela or Afghanistan. And you've had us live our earthly round right now, in this time, not 1,800 years ago, under the boot of Rome, like we're going to talk about tonight. But by the wisdom of our fathers, you've given us real lawful authority over the corrupt, arrogant D.C. boot that's on our necks like a Caesar, because we've been ignorant and we've been slothful, and because we've abdicated our duty. Your grace is just that; it's grace. We don't deserve it. We don't even understand why you provided it, Father. America outstripped Sodom a long time ago in the heinousness of our national sins, just the depths to which we have sunk. I suppose you're keeping your word to Abram all those centuries ago when you said you wouldn't destroy us for the sake of just 10 righteous in a community. And I guess that's the only thing that can possibly explain why you haven't destroyed this place. But Lord, we ask that this series of lessons tonight and in the months and years to come, as people find them and play them and learn about the militia, that they might inform and inspire and encourage your remnant, those in America that you've chosen to stand up, to bear arms when need be, to serve on juries when called, so that we can restore and so that we can defend the most magnificent rule of law, the most ingenious design of limited government that's ever been devised by mankind. We thank you for this. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you, David. Good evening, everyone. This is John Lazorek of West Virginia, co-founder of America Again Trust and a board member of Tactical Civics Institute. Tonight, we're going to continue our series on Who Killed America's Militias. We're going to take a deeper dive into the history of how armies have been employed by politicians and have themselves employed politicians going all the way back to Rome, often thought of as the cradle of Western civilization. When Ben Franklin, emerging from the Constitutional Convention, answered Lady Powell with, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it," he meant that the Constitution would only last as long as the people's will to enforce it through the pre-existing common law institutions of grand juries and militias, and statesmen who served short terms in relatively powerless districts. This is the design, the fundamental design of our Constitution. But it's not what we're doing now, not by a long shot, not what we've been doing for generations. We've often reiterated on these calls how it was Lincoln, who created the first full-time paid U.S. Army. But how and why did Americans allow this illegal army to keep being paid and deployed after the war ended, and even after 12 years of so-called Reconstruction failed. Today, tens of thousands of patriotic American families hold an abiding love for and an allegiance to their military service branch, or to our brave service men and women in general. As individuals in harm's way, most of them richly deserve it. But we the people stipulated in the U.S. Constitution, for abundant good reasons, that a full-time U.S. Army cannot and must not exist. It's a crime. So, why did the framers of the Constitution put this in the law? Why were they so insistent on prohibiting a standing army? Well, first, because none of the states would ratify the new Constitution without that restriction against an army, like one that belongs to a fellow you've all heard of named Julius Caesar 18 centuries before. So tonight we're going to travel back to the Roman Empire to illuminate the parallel, the scary parallel to the Washington, D.C. Empire of the past 135 years. We will lay a foundation in ethics, in economics, and civics, so you can begin to appreciate why our citizen militia has to exist to maintain our sovereign states against the constant threat, not only from foreign enemies, but from plunderers, tyrants, and currency debasers.
Currency debasers. And on the flip side, John, the militias had to be destroyed so billionaires could make their new industries and hire their countless serfs to help them build their estates on the backs of the taxpaying masses. They had to destroy the militias. As we discuss why a full-time army is always needed for empire, folks, remember this historical fact. As far as we're concerned, America expanded to 300% of its former land area within just two generations. Think about that. Think about if we still had a bunch more land, you know, off to the west or north, or let's say we took over Mexico or Canada or something, but with no people in it. Well, hardly any people. Talk about a bonanza. Talk about a windfall for a bunch of industries, okay? So this happened. So the shrewd, the ambitious, the unprincipled man, what does he love? He loves money more than anything. So with money, you can buy power, right? You can get anything with money. So you recruit politicians to build armies so they can work as your mercenaries for plunder, see? And it's all paid for, not by you, it's paid for by the taxpayer. So we need to cover this history of the Roman Empire tonight to show how without an armed force, you can't rule, you can't plunder. With armed force, you can build an empire.
That's right, and that's what's been going on. Just like our country through the second half of the 19th and all the 20th centuries, the Roman Empire tells us an eerily similar tale of the wily, wealthy few using Machiavellian economics, currency manipulation, military power, and government reorganization to serve themselves. They built a population of government wards and bureaucrats who gladly fed on the ignorant, apathetic masses. The elites got the free services they needed, and the bureaucrats got cushy lifelong careers. Remember, we're talking about ancient Rome. I know it sounds too familiar.
It sounds like DC.
The Roman Empire was, of course, not the first to employ paid armies as thugs for emperors, kings, priests, guildsmen, powerful merchants, landowners, and politicians. America has our two people's law enforcement institutions, the grand jury and the militia, precisely because our Constitution was designed by men who knew those grim histories of democratic Athens and of the massive, originally republic of the Roman Empire that grew out of a small republic. The arrangement has a downside, of course. This army that you produce, it's your enforcer, of course, for fleecing the masses. But what's to stop it from turning on you?
That's right. Military coup. John, for about 40 years, beginning in 193 AD, Roman leaders were basically, they were held hostage by their armies. They would essentially say, look, raise our pay and benefits or we're going to walk. We're not yours anymore. And so, and they kind of had a point. They had to constantly be fighting against Germanic and, you know, Gothic and other barbarian attackers. And when they would see these patrician politicians living high on the hog and stuff, they they wanted some of that loot, you know. So each time a new emperor arose, he was held up by his own army. It was basically a stick-up. Every time you had a new emperor, he had to pay the army a so-called accession bonus, basically a bribe. So they would stay loyal to the new guy. So whether you were a wealthy Roman patrician or whether you were an emperor in need of funds to pay your bureaucrats and your palace expenses and stuff, if you wanted protection for your family, if you wanted mercenaries so you could go squeeze victims, you know, when you're out plundering, you pay the soldiers. Whatever they demand, you pay those guys. So the Roman Empire was controlled by its armies.
Of course, just as Lincoln and his Congress did with the introduction of paper counterfeits for honest silver dollars, Rome's emperors had to find a way to meet the bribery burden. They began debasing the coinage with bronze and copper. Predictably, this led to a period of hyperinflation. In what's known as the crisis of the third century, from about 235 to 284 AD, the empire almost collapsed under a combination of threats. First, they had the Goth, the Visigoth, and the Alemanni invasions and migrations into Roman territory. Second, civil wars and political instability grew as many politicians made competing claims as emperor. Everybody wanted to be emperor, and there was no established succession rule. Thirdly, under pressure from patrician families and demanding soldiers, as I just said, politicians kept debasing the currency. Then finally, you had a plague of smallpox, which led to an economic depression if the debased currency wasn't enough, which then led to peasant revolts. So this empire, being spread so far and so thin and with so many dead from the plague, Rome was forced to hire barbarian mercenaries who worked cheaper than Roman legionaries, but who also were more independent. And on top of all this, yes, there was the plague, and in some cities, the fatality rate was as high as 60% of the population. This put massive pressure on industry and also on army recruitment.
Yep. Let me back up just a second, John, to fill in a couple of blanks. The crisis of the third century started when an emperor named Severus Alexander was assassinated. He was killed by his own troops in 235. They acclaimed their general, Maximinus Thrax, was a cool name, right? He was their new emperor, and he was the first of the so-called barracks emperors. And although he had a cool name, Maximinus Thrax, he was a big, low-bred Roman. He hated the rich Roman patricians, but he hated Christians too. He killed whenever he could kill a Christian, he would. Anyway, when his army beat and enslaved the Alemanni hordes, he gave himself the name Germanicus Maximus, and he named his son Maximus. So now you know where the producers of Gladiator got the Maximus character from. But anyway, as the name Thrax implies, he wasn't from Spain, like in the movie. He was from Thrace, which is today kind of southern Bulgaria. Anyway, the barracks emperors, these were all military guys. They didn't have distinguished ancestors. They weren't from rich families. They didn't have any political experience. They didn't have a supporting faction, you know, among the taxpayers or anything. They were just thug chieftains, you know. They had an anarchist bent or whatever, but they weren't much different from the barbarians' chieftains. They were just, you know, they wore Roman uniforms. But anyway, in the 50-year period that you were talking about, John, the crisis of the third century, 26 different politicians claimed the title of emperor. And you start, most of them were these barracks emperors. And they were claiming power over either all or part of the empire. And in those same 50 years, plus or minus, actually a little bit later and running a little bit later, the Senate named 26 different emperors. So it was like a spaghetti bowl of intrigues and double crosses. If you read Roman history for this period, it's like, wow, you cannot keep the names straight. All the assassinations and the splits and the competing states and stuff. They ended up with three. competing states. The Gallic Empire was Britain, France, and Spain. The Palmyrene Empire was Palestine, Egypt, and Syria. And the Roman Empire, the proper Roman Empire, was just, I guess, basically what is today Italy. Anyway, sorry about that.
No, that's good. Thank you, David, for filling in all those details. But from our distant vantage point, anyway, by the year 270, Emperor Aurelian reunited the empire. And Emperor Diocletian, with a long list of reforms, finally ended the crisis in 284. Instead of breaking up the empire again, Diocletian shared power over one united Roman Empire. First he had one colleague, and then he had three, which was called the Roman Tetrarchy, from the Greek word tetra for four. As you might imagine, that led to more civil wars, until Constantine came on the scene, and he forged an empire that lasted until 476 AD in the West, and all the way up until 1453 AD in the East. Constantine the Great ruled in himself from 306 to 337. He was born to an Illyrian father named Constantius and a Greek mother named Helena in a small town in what we today call Serbia. His dad was a Caesar and deputy emperor in the West, so he made Constantine his son a military tribune. Then in 305, when his dad became an Augustus and senior Western emperor, he called Constantine to join him in a military campaign in Britannia. Constantius, the father, died the following year, and the Roman army, while stationed in what today is known as York in England, in what is today England, acclaimed Constantine as the new emperor. So, once again, a barracks emperor from among the soldiery, Constantine created mobile field units, garrisoned units to counter internal uprisings and barbarian attacks. He led successful military campaigns on the empire's frontiers against the barbarian Franks, the Alemanni, the Goths, and the Sarmatians. He even resettled territories that had been abandoned by his predecessors during the crisis of the 3rd century.
Yep, he was one of the good barracks emperors. And Constantine, he was decisive. He was, of course, he was brutal when he had to be. But he instituted the two most important civil reforms in the whole history of Rome. If you look at it, if you back out and look at the whole thing, first, he separated the Roman, now this was a barracks emperor, remember, but he separated Rome's military and civil authorities. He split the government now so that the armies couldn't any longer pick the rulers and couldn't hold the empire hostage for more loot and more benefits and stuff while they were plundering. That was huge. That was huge. That was a giant economic change. Secondly, Constantine ended government counterfeiting. They had been doing all this, as you were saying, John, cheapening their money every year. And so he instituted a solid gold, like the word solid. It was called a solidus. Later on, it was called the Byzant, in Byzantium. Anyway, in the Easter, that Byzant, that gold coin that Constantine instituted became all of Europe's favored coin of the realm for 1,000 years. It was the longest lived coinage in history. And also, probably the most important for world history, is that Constantine was the first Roman emperor that converted to Christianity. So very much unlike Maximinus Thrax, who hated Christians, Constantine converted. He was a pagan most of his life, but he was late in life. He was a catechumen. He was learning, and then finally he proclaimed his faith in Christ on his deathbed. At least that's how it's told. Anyway, he was influential. He proclaimed the Edict of Milan in 313, which was basically tolerating Christianity in the empire. He called the First Council of Nicaea in 325. That's where we get the Nicene Creed from, and much more. He ordered the construction of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre supposedly at the site of Jesus' tomb in Jerusalem. So in tonight's story, John and I are showing how history is repeating itself right here in our internet age, because as you hear these stories of Rome, just notice, like the Roman Empire, the Washington, D.C. of today is not going to be the Washington, D.C. of 20 years from now. If tactical civics succeeds, even if we don't succeed, but especially if we do, Washington, D.C. is not going to remain as it is. So, John, can you start describing that next, that big watershed in Western history?
Sure. Well, we have been discussing a gradual but profound change in human association and civil government, and we particularly want to illustrate the vital part played by armed force in one form or another. After the crisis of the 3rd century, dozens of formerly thriving cities, especially in the Western Empire, had been ruined by economic breakdown of trading networks, by constant warfare and crooked money. Many major cities and towns, including Rome itself, had not needed fortification for centuries because, you've heard the phrase, the Pax Romana, because the organization of the empire had kept the peace. But now they had to start building themselves walls. They were no longer able to safely export their crops over long distances, so large landowners began producing food mostly for their own manors and for local barter. Rather than importing manufactured goods from the empire's great cities, they began manufacturing goods on their own estates. This home-based business boom was called manorialism in the Middle Ages, but it's actually reminiscent of the system in the American South before Lincoln's War. The common free people of the Roman cities began moving to the countryside and to smaller towns in search of food and better protection. They became a semi-free class of Roman citizen known as coloni. That's where we get the word colony today. They were tied to the land where they settled, and by Roman law, that status became hereditary. And this then is the root of the British landed gentry and of feudal serfs paying rent to the gentry.
That's right. Yeah, that's the root of feudalism. And the militia sort of starts here, too, because out of economic necessity, you had these former city dwellers and many small farmers. They start obtaining their protection from the large landholders, or the troops that are hired by the large landholders, instead of requiring the Roman legions. So these new armed part-time defenders of the manorial lands of the villages were the earliest precursor to the militia that we see that I've talked about many, many months ago in the time of King Ethelred, which was basically 5 centuries later. So now armies, if you wanted to call them armies, they were short-term, they were one-shot, they were mostly volunteer armed men, they were raised from the manor village for their own defense needs. See how different this is? Now it's defense, that's the key. This is now a defensive military. The essential character of the constitutional militia is the antithesis of mercenary militaries that work for a predatory industry, for a predatory government. It's completely the opposite. It's defensive. It's the founding fathers constantly talked about this. They constantly wrote about it, that antithesis between paid armies and volunteer militias of the people. Anyway, sorry. Back to you, John. It's a fascinating story.
It is. I really have trouble now understanding how history is made so boring in school. It's all about how we got where we are today. And gosh, do we ever need to learn its lessons. Not to have to relearn them the hard way. So as these large landowners became of necessity more self-sufficient and less obedient to Rome's central authority, naturally they became hostile toward its tax collectors. They weren't getting any value for all those taxes anymore. Now your measure of wealth had less to do with being a powerful patrician in the big city and more to do with how large a farm you had. The common people of the empire lost economic and political status to a new landholding nobility, and the urban middle classes lost their place, along with their shrinking livelihoods. The ethics and economics of New Testament Christianity are a subject for another podcast that we really need to get to, but the Roman Empire's crisis of the 3rd century did begin its long decline from a world empire to a third-rate bit player today. We believe that the Internet revolution similarly threatens Washington, D.C.'s empire that began with its military occupation of our 50 sovereign states. Washington, D.C., folks, will not always rule our lives. Just like the corrupt patrician senators of Rome, splitting plunder with their wealthy friends and mercenary armies, the D.C. deep state and its powerful politicians are facing fundamental change. As you always say, David, some days the world just changes. It changed for arrogant Rome, as we here tonight are working to change it for arrogant D.C. At the height of its power, Rome claimed 55 to 60 million people, including women, slaves, and other classes under its rule who weren't considered citizens. So the Roman Empire was 15% of the world's population at the peak of its power. The Washington, D.C. Empire claims 325 million citizens and, probably 30 million or more illegal aliens. In total, about 5% of the world's current population. But Washington, D.C. is many times more powerful relatively than was the Roman Empire, whereas most of the population of the Roman Empire lived within easy reach of the Mediterranean Sea. Washington, D.C. can project military power virtually anywhere on Earth in minutes. Sadly, on behalf of multinational banks and corporations. Of course, it wants us to think that they're protecting American interests abroad.
American interests abroad. Oh, they love to use that term, don't they?
Indeed, they do.
And we think, what? Wait, American? Is that my interest? No, it's not. It's ExxonMobil's interest. It's not my. I don't have ExxonMobil stock. Anyway, John, there's a term in economics called rent seeking, and I know you know the term. It's when somebody's seeking to increase his wealth, his share of the total existing wealth, without creating any new wealth. So it's called rent seeking. It doesn't have anything to do with rent. So it's kind of funny. People don't get it. You know, why do they call it rent seeking? Well, because when the landed gentry used to get rent from serfs, they didn't do anything for it. They didn't actually own the land. The king, the crown, owned all the land. But the landed gentry used to collect rent. So anyway, they call it rent seeking. When you're looking to get stuff for nothing, you don't do anything for it. So a rent seeker, like a multinational corporation, like a multi-generational bureaucrat, like a multi-generational welfare family, see, those are rent seekers. They seek something for nothing. They're not bringing anything to the table. They're getting, see. So you have to use politicians or regulatory agencies or armies because of what's called there's another thing called the Tulloch, T-U-L-L-O-C-K, the Tulloch paradox, which has to do with bribery. The Tulloch paradox says that when you bribe someone, when you bribe a politician, it's very cheap. A rent seeker, a cheater, can get stuff from a government by paying a tiny little bribe, pennies on the dollar, because if a bribe gets too big, the politician stands a much better chance of getting caught, getting seen, and ending up in prison. So the Tulloch paradox is it's actually cheaper to get money that way than any other way. So a lot of people do it. Legislation, see, that's what legislation today, folks, is super easy to write. If you're a big corporation, it's very easy to get your legislation passed and pushed through. You pay a little bribe, just a little one. And every industry does this today. We've talked about that a lot. But all of this is part of, it's rent seeking. It's somebody living on your back, living without doing anything. They're not bringing anything to America's table. They're just taking. You remember, I don't know when it was, last fall sometime or something, I talked about another principle of economics called moral hazard. You might remember. You charge or you extort from a big group of people only a little tax for each one, see, from each one. They don't resist you, that extortion or that, you know, charge or whatever, because it doesn't, it's not, you're not squeezing each one very hard. It's not enough pain to make them react, in other words. So I'd say a quick definition of moral hazard is small bites, many victims. So in dollar volume, though, Washington, D.C. is the world's moral hazard and rent-seeking marketplace of the world.
Wow. Thin on the hoof. Beginning with good old Lincoln. take away other people's lawful money, take their liberty, and take their means of law enforcement and community defense, then you can have your government toadies put them all under a yoke of taxation. So they're working for you all their lives.
All their lives.
Power over all the states, you move on. And at the end of the 19th century, that's what our country started to do. We're moving on out to the far-flung islands of the world in search of plunder. What kind of plunder, you ask? Well, in land, it's square miles or acres. With steel, it's how many tons can you mine, smelt, and ship. With oil, we measure it in barrels. Natural gas, it's millions of cubic feet. Timber, it's millions of board feet. With fish, it's tons, and with gold, it's ounces. For the most ruthless scoundrels, best of all is counterfeit banknotes. The safest, the cheapest, the lightest to carry. Nothing but keystrokes and air, and called legal by the most powerful government in the world. You can counterfeit hundreds of billions of U.S. dollars. And the best part? They're operating Congress's own counterfeiting concession. So nobody can nail you for the crime.
Yep, amen.
But foreign plunder takes guns and bombs and mercenaries, because all those people don't want to give up what's theirs. You need all these things to frighten or kill the people who have the stuff you want. Oh, you tell them, and particularly you tell the gullible people back home, that you're there to settle their local tribal conflicts, or to bring democracy, as England did with India and South Africa and many other far-flung islands of the world. In Rudyard Kipling's immortal words, you represent yourself as selflessly bearing the white man's burden.
The white man's burden. Yeah, that's how Kipling put it. Before England, though, it was Spain and France and Holland and Portugal. They didn't have any democracy to offer, of course. They were all monarchies, but they used religion as their cover. But none of them could get their plunder done without paid mercenaries. So this is what the Founding Fathers knew. All of this history we've talked about tonight, the Founding Fathers dealt in this every day, all the time. They talked about it all the time. Notice how different the plunder and the standing armies are from what the Founding Fathers designed, what we the people task our militias of our states to do. Totally different. How we limit armies to just 2 years maximum deployment in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 12, 13, one of those in there. Anyway, no full-time paid army. That's our law, folks. It's the law. How can there be this illegal army all these years? Well, there is. It's illegal. Totally illegal. Don't tell that to any member of the U.S. Army. He'll kill you. Good old Lincoln. And how's this? How's this for hypocrisy from Lincoln? He delivered an impassioned speech. They called it the Spot Resolution speech in February of 1848. He was griping about President Polk, who had declared war on Mexico. And in the treaty after the war, after we won the war, could have taken all of Mexico, but we didn't. In the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, for 15 million, we paid 15 million bucks to Mexico, and Washington, D.C. got Mexico to give up Arizona, California, part of Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, Texas, and Utah, part of Utah. 15 million bucks. All of which land, by the way, Mexico had taken from Spain, obviously, before, and Spain had taken it from the Indian nations. And the Indian nations were constantly taking it from one another. So, I mean, it was always somebody taking it from somebody. But here was Lincoln. My point is, Lincoln got so upset with Polk. 12 years later, while 18 other countries were abolishing slavery without firing one shot, without having a war, Lincoln declares war on his own sovereigns, kills over 750,000 Americans. But thinks he has the right to gripe at President Polk. Anyway, as soon as the U.S. Army occupied the formerly sovereign states, bing-ching, American industrialists had dreams of much more.
Yes, much more, indeed. They sure did. Wars, of course, serve another vital purpose. their distractions and team-building exercises for nationalism. Beginning with Hawaii in 1893, the D.C. Empire ratcheted ahead in 1898 with a mysterious false flag explosion on the USS Maine, and that allowed President McKinley to get away with declaring war on Spain. Why Spain, you ask? Well, because it held Cuba, which is too close to Florida for comfort. Plus, they have sugar and coffee producers. They also wanted Cuba and Puerto Rico. And because the war industry needed Guam and the Philippines for coaling stations, so with one inexpensive, quick, distracting, chest-thumping little war, the U.S. Navy, which is, after all, constitutional, though hardly for the purpose it was being used for, the U.S. Navy could provide mercenary services, all at zero cost, to the American corporations seeking all that sugar and all that land and plunder. The Philippines' coaling stations, of course, were to defend trade routes, for U.S. companies operating in the South China Sea. And while they were there, well, why not have those free mercenaries run protection for the corporations extracting the coffee, the timber, the oil, the sugar, the rubber, the pineapples, and more from all those islands? So the cost of one little explosion and $20 million of the taxpayers' money paid to Spain, Washington, D.C. bought the people of Puerto Rico, of Guam, and the Philippines as vassals. They only let the Cuban people go free after they agreed to add the Platt Amendment to Cuba's constitution, allowing Washington, D.C. to maintain a naval base at Guantanamo Bay in perpetuity. Given Cuba's proximity, just 90 miles from Florida, that would be the only one that made sense, even though it also is not constitutional.
Right. At the time, it did, at least that made sense, having a naval base on that island, but after pretending to be freeing them, the U.S. Army and the Navy and the Marines subdued and fought the Filipino people, exactly as Spain had been doing. We didn't free them. Washington, D.C. to this day still controls Guam, and it only left the Philippines in 1992 after almost a century of military occupation. And Washington, D.C. similarly, same thing, occupied and claimed the Samoan Islands, along with England and Germany, finally in 1899, I forget the name of the treaty, but they had some tripartite treaty or something like that it was called. It was the three powers, Germany, England, and Washington, D.C., all looked at the Samoan Islands and said, okay, I want this one, I want that one. Anyway, the Samoan, the islands of Tonga, the Solomon Islands, all of those, they kind of divvied them up, said, okay, I need coaling stations here, I'll trade you this island for that one. Anyway, it's absurd. In 1846, Jefferson Davis, who became the president of the Confederacy, he said, quote, "The evils of war must fall upon the people, and with them the war feeling should originate. We, their representatives, are but a mirror to reflect the light and never should become a torch to fire the pile." Unquote.
Wow. There is a beautiful quote to end on. What a statesman he was. Well, from Rome's empire to Washington, D.C.'s empire for industry, seems like a long journey, but now maybe you see how short a journey it is, and now you see the real purpose behind paid full-time armies, and why the founders despised them and insisted that militias were to be our means of defense instead. That's a good bite for tonight. Johnny B., do we have people who want to weigh in on this? Let's open it up.
Well, I'm kind of contrasting the historical insight of the original authors of the documents, of our four documents. And that's I'm contrasting at least 75 years of people in that time, because it took those people to raise the children that created the works, right? I'm contrasting that historical insight and the drawn-out process of the way the mechanism of creating the conspirators with Lincoln and then the Grant's Union administration of the last century and a half, and how the latter the conspirators reflect all the authors would discuss while they were in study, then convention, and then finally Congress, leading up to 1789.
87.
So it's like they got to see, 87. Yeah, it's when they actually formed it together. It seemed to me like they would hear all the discussion, you know, the people that had studied it, all the historical, political, social political structures. Okay.
Well, there was and a big, as you know, there was a big, big fight with, well, Patrick Henry walked out early and said, "I smelt a rat," and he wouldn't even stay because he felt that it was going to be a disaster. And he had already done a lot of speaking and writing on it. John, his essentially second cousin, John Taylor of Caroline, was the same way. He was very much a what they later started calling anti-federalist. They were for truly for real federalism. They were for true constitutional federalism, Article 4, Section 4 federalism. But the whole deal about military was a big, big fight, too. And that started because, as you recall, Alexander Hamilton had been aide-de-camp for Washington, and Washington was still real big on... He was a professional soldier. I mean, he had been for England, and he had been for America, and he was the first real general we had and all that. So he was, and he saw what it was like to try to herd cats with militia. And so he and not just he and Hamilton, but he and Hamilton and others were big Federalists in terms of armies, in terms of saying, no, we need a national army, Hamilton gave it he had a plan. It was called the New Army. and boy, howdy, people despised him for it. They despised him. They called him all kinds of names for it. They raked him over the coals for it, and he paid dearly for that, just like he paid dearly for his British plan at the convention. They shot him down immediately. So when you go back and look at how it always happens, and they had written about this again and again and again, look, if you have an army and you're paying them, they're going to go bad. Because if they're willing to do stuff for money, it's who's going to pay them the most money? As we were talking about tonight with Rome, it got to be where, hey, guys, wait a minute. The emperor is paying us to be here, right? Why don't we ask him for more? And hey, if he won't give us more, we walk. I mean, it's just duh. If you're doing it for the money, see, when you're defending your home, when you're defending your town, do you see how different that is? Eldridge Gerry and many others spoke about this. They talked often about this, about how there's a huge difference between what a militiaman does and what a paid military man does. A paid professional is there to kill people and break things. That's you get paid to do that. They send you, they deploy you. Look what they call it, deployment. They deploy you like a robot. They send you off and they say, break these things, kill these people, do this, do that. With snipers, it's even more, you want to kill this guy at this spot, try to catch him here, you know, this and that. And if you were a military sniper, you knew officers first, highest officers first, you know. I mean, it's very different. You're a professional killer. That's what you're paid for. You're not paid to tickle somebody. You're paid to kill them. So when you see that, you say, wow, is that what we're all – no, that's not what we're all about. Is that how we act today? Yes. You talk to military people today, especially young ones who don't know any better, who haven't talked to the older generals yet and seen what war is really about. And man, these guys they're raised by the, you know, in the video game culture where this active shooter thing, it's absurd, man. This is not what it is to be an American. This is absurd.
Sure.
Anyway, I'm sorry to get off on that, but this has gone all the way back to before the Constitutional Convention. The thing about the armies, where we got our idea for the indictment engine was from the 28th Federalist written by Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton was trying to pitch this new army, this army that was in Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 12 through 16. He was trying to pitch to the people of New York because they were turning it down. They were saying, nope, we don't like this Constitution. And he had, well, he and John Jay and James Madison had to write those Federalist papers basically to convince, to sell the people of the different colonies, especially New York at that time, to say yes. And so since Alexander Hamilton was from New York, he was the banker's boy, the big banker's boy. Anyway, he in the 28th Federalist, if you read it, you'll see what he says. He says, look, this can't be a problem. This federal army will never be a problem because if it ever gets out of whack, the people will call their states, meaning their militias, call them up and they will preponderate. If, on the other hand, the state militia should get, you know, one of the states should get out of whack and get, you know, arrogant or tyrannical, then the people will call in this new national army and they will preponderate. In either case, Hamilton guarantees us, the people will preponderate. Those are his words in the 28th Federalist. So he's trying to say, look, don't worry about this army. Anyway, it's only for up to 2 years. It's not a full time. You know, don't worry. Just go with it. Well, he was wrong. Sure. Lincoln flipped that on its head. And a lot of people knew that he was going to be wrong, and a lot of people said it, but not enough people. And so since the Constitution was fixing a whole lot more things than it seemed to be messing up, it was ratified and approved, and the rest is history. But that was one of the things that people, they fought about quite a bit because they knew it was going to be a problem to have any kind of a federal army, any kind of a national army, even if just for 2 years. And you can go find the debates on this and find the writing. There were plenty of people who were willing to speak out about it, but they just weren't listened to.
Bill Hosey come to me earlier this afternoon and asked me a question on the grand jury and where it actually appears in the Constitution. And that led me to reading some commentary, actually a little bit of history on what's been going on with the federal government and Supreme Court and the grand jury process and the way they're trying to reflect the people's grand jury into the federal grand jury process. And they actually talk about how it doesn't work. You know, it has two opposing functions, I think, was one statement it makes. And I was like, yeah, because you're trying to stick something in there that doesn't belong.
That's right. Yeah, it's only opposing because you're making it that way.
Yeah, right. I mean, it was obvious. This smacked me right in the face.
First you break it, and then you bring it and say, look, it's broken. Yeah,
right,
I know.
Absolutely.
I saw you break it. Yeah, the whole grand jury thing is another whole issue that we're going to have to handle separately, and we will. We'll walk through it.
Oh, yeah.
We'll do our whole 17 points and all that, probably two or three Sunday night calls to cover that. But that one's fascinating, too, how that was taken over. But we're getting next Sunday and the Sunday after when we finish, God willing, when we finish this series, we will show how this creeping series of changes that the states and the federal government made as they started backing away and backing away and backing away from the Constitution and saying, we're already doing this, so why don't we do this? Well, since we're doing this, why don't we give it a new name? It's just a new name. It's not. We're not changing. And between changing names and changing functions, you're watching a ratchet, a constant ratchet. It always goes one way. Big government, big government, big government. When you have people saying, why doesn't the state do it? No, because the federal government is a much more, it's more efficient. It's more cost-effective. Why would you want to waste, do this 50 times when we can do it once? We'll save you money, So it's always the same pitch. But you have to go back. The reason we took you back to Rome tonight was that to see some things never change. I mean, it's really amazing. Rich guys don't get that way by being nice guys. They get that way by being sons of blanketies, you know? And that's just the way the world is. That's the way the tribal chieftains of caveman days, you know, the strongest one always won because he would kill the other guy first, you know, and then carry his head around and bellow as everybody watched. So we have to bring people, Americans today, to understand, guy, if you would rather watch TV or do any, you know, whatever you're doing in your yard or your house or even with your kids, whatever, then go to a militia muster or to a training event or whatever, even just once a month. Come on, once a month? It's not too much to ask. Now, a lot of people say, I already do. I go to my National Guard stuff. And National Guard, yeah, but National Guard is a usurpation. We're going to get into that next Sunday. If government usurps something and gives it a name and says, oh, it's the same as this. No, it's not. I can show you that it's not. The federal government cannot do this thing. This thing has to be done. Like we talked about tonight, like we talked about two Sundays ago, if the federal government does it, it can't be militia. The only thing the federal government can do is the president can call up the militia if he needs to, but he can't send them overseas like Tom Woodrow Wilson did. He wasn't supposed to, but once he did, Katie barred the doors. Now they could go overseas. It didn't matter that you were a state force. You got sent overseas. If you were militia, too bad. You're getting deployed. You're going to, you know, wherever. It's ridiculous.
It happens because people don't know. They don't know their own rights. They don't know their own power.
They don't know their own authority. Yeah, it's the authority. It's not rights. There's no rights involved. In fact, right. We have an authority here to do something, and this is why it's so hard to use the term law enforcement, but that's what it is. We're talking about a law enforcement function. If you read the Constitution, you see it. It says execute the laws of the Union. What is it? That's law enforcement. Okay, so. Okay, raise your hand if you want to do law enforcement. A room of 100 guys, you know, maybe 2, 3, you know, raise their hand. Oh, cool, me, pick me. You know, but you're not going to get 51 of them to raise their hand. So
it seems to me there's one aspect of the militia that a lot of people don't realize. And I personally think the militia serves a more important purpose for the grand jury.
I think so too. That's right. And that is what that is the unusual, the unprecedented, the historic way that we're trying to start getting people to think of those two together. In other words,
amen.
When you think of the grand jury as just a bunch of people, some of them little old ladies that say, wait a minute, I'm scared. What if I tell this guy, you know, what if I say, okay, we're going to get this guy. I can't go get him. You know, if she's a 73-year-old woman and she says, I'm not carrying an AR, you know, what do you do? Well, you're not supposed to go. You're on the grand jury. Nobody's supposed to know your name. They're not supposed to see. So right. You're supposed to instruct. You are supposed to give the arrest order or whatever order you have. You have now the power, the top law enforcement power in the county, to say what's going to happen. So you tell the local militia, and the militia goes and does that for you. That's exactly, and when Richard Mack talks about the sheriff, look, if the sheriff is involved, fantastic. If the sheriff is on board, great. What if the sheriff's not, or even worse, what if the sheriff's crooked, or what if the sheriff is the target? So we're trying to indict the sheriff. You're not going to get him to help us. So if we're trying to indict the sheriff, all of his people are probably also, you know, maybe some of them will turn, but hey, you never know. You have to have counterforce. So in order to start thinking in law enforcement terms, we have to get all these Sunday warriors with all their cool, I won't say the word, stuff, all their cool firearms and their cool, you know, tactical gear and stuff that they love to show off in, we're going to have to get them to actually use it and actually act like like a law enforcement unit in their community. You know, the other day I saw on Facebook several times in one day, many times in one day, the same article. It's some aerial photo of a little shanty camp thing, you know, with a bunch of tires around it, and it's supposed to be a Muslim training camp. You know, some sheets of tin creating a roof, and you know, some pieces of visqueen and I don't know what else. And it looks like a little dump, a little place where maybe 8 or 10 guys can camp out or something, who knows. And they say, well, these camps are all over the U.S. There are dozens of them, of these training camps. Now, if those guys are out there and they're just shooting, and let's say they're outside the city limits and, you know, they're doing basically what you and I would do when we go out and shoot, then even if they're screaming Allah's name while they're doing it, you can't arrest them for that. This is America. They're free to do that. If they go out in the sticks and shoot, that's their deal. I mean, if they're screaming Allah's name, let them scream Allah's name. I don't give a hoot. Now, if they try to do bad stuff, we get them. Not only do we get them, we destroy that camp where they train. That's fine. The militia can do that. Now, imagine a militia times 3,142. One for every county in these United States. There's a militia unit, and let's say it's only 20 guys or 30 guys. In some places it's maybe 40, and in some places it's maybe 2,000, because some counties have a lot of people. You could have more than 2,000. So you've got big militia units and small militia units. And let's say a small militia unit has a Muslim camp, an Islamic jihadist camp, where they're doing serious training, and somebody has done something somewhere that's illegal, and you can get them. So you want to go take that camp out. You want to destroy that camp, and you want to make sure they can't go start it again. And now you've been able to put it together and say, this is where this guy trained. Before he killed those 9 people, he trained at this training camp. This training camp is now shut down. Well, you can take it. The government can seize that property, just like you would, you know, any murderer, any, you know. So it's law enforcement. It's just law. It's not military. It's law enforcement. So when you treat it that way and you say, let's all obey the law, make the Muzzy obey the law, and also we obey the law, we win. Folks, if we've got, we don't even have to be in every county. We can be in every fifth county, and we'd still vastly, vastly outnumber them. We're also, I believe, we would also be far better equipped and better shot and all of that. Have much better morale, better team tactics, and all of those things, I believe. But again, it's not... So people would rather run these stories and say, oh, look, there's Muslim training camps. Yeah, what about it? I can show you a bunch of deer camps where a bunch of guys get drunk and go shoot and do all kinds of crazy stuff. In fact, some of them have killed one another. Even when they're wearing bright orange, blaze orange jackets, they still get shot, you know? So, I mean, stuff happens.
I kind of figured that was the hog camp. You know how we have deer camps. That would be a hog camp out there. To hunt hog.
Maybe so.
Oh, man, that's a crazy sport. I kind of brushed up against it down there in southern Oklahoma.
Oh, especially when they use choppers, when they go.
Right.
Have you seen from helicopters? They do that here in Texas.
No.
Oh, man, they wipe them out. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because there's no, since they're invasive exotics or whatever, they're, you
exactly.
know, invasive species ruining farmers' land and ruining everything.
You
can shoot as many hogs as you want, wild hogs as you want. And so these guys get up in a helicopter with fully auto ARs, AR-10s, okay? 308, full auto, and you just see this dirt trail going, five pigs fall. Anyway, it's pretty, I'd like to do it. I mean, I have to say, I do not like wild hogs. I've seen what they do.
Yeah.
They're a menace. There's over 5 million in Texas, and they're tearing this place up. So anyway, I'd love to get in a helicopter and do that. But anyway, that has nothing to do with...
Right. That's the fun side of militia.
Okay. Well, we've enjoyed tonight. I hope you have. We will be, God willing and providing, back again at the same time next Sunday night to continue this series and try to end up with a... When the series is finished, we want to end up answering every conceivable question about why we don't have militia today, what happened to it, and how. So that's what we're trying to do with this series. We're trying to give you enough history, show you where things came from, why things happened the way they did. Next time we're going to talk a lot about the states, what the states did, and what the federal government did, neither of which should have done that, to help destroy the militias of the several states. So thank you very much for being with us. God bless you. Good night.
To learn more about this subject and more on our blog and Facebook group, and to take action in your county, go to tacticalcivics.com.